I'm now joined by Rob Harvey, co-head of product specialist at Dimensional, who currently offers 38 ETFs with $130 billion in assets. That's been done in about 3.5 years. They didn't launch their first ETF until November of 2020. And of course, Dimensional takes a systematic, active approach to investing and their ETF lineup overall, which will be the focus of my conversation with Rob, who is now on the line with me from Austin. Rob, great to connect and welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
All right, so let's start with that growth of the Dimensional ETF lineup. As I mentioned, you have gone from literally $0 in ETF assets to now $130 billion in about 3.5 years. That is across 38 ETFs. iShow, you're now the 8th largest ETF issuer. And, you know, look, high level, obviously, that includes some mutual fund ETF conversions. And I'm sure some prior Dimensional investors have also simply switched from the mutual fund to ETF wrapper. But no matter how you slice this, it's been a highly impressive last few years. And, you know, even so far this year, I show nearly $8 billion in net inflows. And so to start, just talk about the overall growth of the lineup and perhaps what stood out to you in terms of investor interest.
Yeah, well, you're so right. You hit on a lot of the important points that we like to reiterate it as well, which is this has grown from nothing. We weren't in the space in 2019. And so to have $130 billion now be the single largest active ETF issuer in the market, that's pretty impressive. And, you know, you also mentioned that the product suite has grown to 38 ETFs. We expect that product suite to grow over time. I think one of the things that's really impressive when you look at the AUM numbers is it's not just a handful of funds that are carrying it. We've actually seen positive flows for every fund in the product suite, not just since inception, but over the last year as well. So you mentioned, you know, we've had good flows to start the year off with so far. That's really been something that we've seen not just in a couple of products, but across the lineup. So that's been great to see as well. You know, the interest that we have in the lineup and the products in general kind of comes from a couple different places. You have your DFA diehards, if you will, who were invested with the mutual funds. They know us. They love us. They were excited about the conversions. They moved, you know, some of their assets when we launched these ETFs. And those are a lot of the people that you see in sort of our more traditional flagship products like DFSV, for example, U.S. Small Cap Value. But you also mentioned, you know, we were able to access financial professionals that we really couldn't talk to before because they were using ETFs exclusively. And we work with close to 40% more financial professionals now than we did 4 or 5 years ago because of the ETFs. And that investor base has different preferences. They have different beliefs. And so what we've seen in the ETFs is we've been able to launch new strategies that are so consistent with our investment philosophy, but really are better tailored to some of the new investors we have. So, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about indexing today. One of the things that we hear from these new investors is they want beta and they want it at a reasonable price. And so they turn to us and say, you know, we like some of the things about indexing, low cost, well diversified, but we want to be able to do it in a better way. Can you help us? And that is really Dimensional's bread and butter. So in our core equity market solutions, for example, only available in ETFs, we've seen a tremendous amount of growth there. They're already over $15 billion. And obviously all of that is new because they didn't exist prior to 2019. And that's been great to see as well.
Well, I think no matter how you slice it, clearly your approach is resonating. And you mentioned just high level your investment approach. You know, it's interesting, Rob, because while Dimensional's ETFs are technically active, it's not the traditional stock picking active management that some people might envision when they hear the word active, right? It's a systematic approach. And that is actually where I thought it might be helpful to spend our time today, because at a very high level, I would say investors have three options. There's traditional stock picking active, there's systematic active, which is what you do, and then there's traditional passive or index-based funds. And I want to compare systematic active versus indexing because I do think this sometimes causes confusion among investors and advisors, at least in my experience. But first, for people unfamiliar, do you want to just explain what systematic active means? And you know, maybe how that compares to traditional stock picking active management, and then we can get into the indexing comparisons.
Yeah, that's great. And I think, you know, I love the fact that you have sort of three boxes that you're putting out there, the traditional active, systematic active, and then you have maybe sort of your passive or indexing. A lot of times when we talk to investors, they've got two boxes in front of them, and it's, are you active or are you passive? And that conversation is interesting because we're kind of both and we're kind of neither. So I don't think it's unhelpful to view things in that context, but I do think it kind of needs some explaining. So what do we mean when we say that we're both and neither? Well, when you think about what are the benefits of indexing, as I said, a lot of it that is attractive to investors is you have broad market diversification and you have low costs. Our founders actually came from working on some of the first index funds all the way back in 1981. And there was a lot of things that they liked about index funds, namely those two things, right? You like this idea of cheap beta, essentially, is attractive. It makes up the core of a lot of investors' portfolios. But there's a couple problems with indexing as well. Namely, number one, you can't utilize the academic research out there. So if you have, you know, the greatest minds in modern financial theory that you've worked with throughout your schoolwork and your professional career, like Eugene Fama, Ken French, you know, Bob Merton, Myron Scholes, none of that's being utilized in an index. So you're kind of leaving money on the table in that sense. And the other issue is with implementation. You can kind of think about it conceptually. Does it make sense to tell the market what you're going to do before you do it? No, of course not. No one in the active space would ever do that, right? Again, you're letting people walk away with money. You're leaving money on the table. So there are issues there, and that's kind of how we differentiate ourselves from indexing, although we're oftentimes confused with indexing because of our low fees. But then you kind of look on the other side of the table, and you've got traditional active. And when we talk about the fact that we're the largest active ETF issuer, I think a lot of people have the idea that we've got highly concentrated portfolios, you know, 30 names, we're reading the tarot cards and the tea leaves, trying to figure out whether or not we like Bank of America better than Citigroup because, you know, something that the CEO said or something like that. You know, that's what you think about with stock pickers. That's traditional active management. And we're nothing like that because it tends to be high fees and high conviction or high concentration. But the goal of active management is to outperform the market. They want to outperform their benchmarks. Now, they're pretty miserable at achieving that. The track record isn't great for survivorship or outperformance. But that goal is something that we have as well. We don't want to just perform as well as an index. We know we can do better. And the track record shows that we have. So when you compare us, again, you've got sort of similarities between both, but we like to think that we're really offering the best of both approaches.
I think that was an excellent description. And again, you know, my sense is I do think many investors can get their head around traditional stock picking versus systematic active. But going back to your description of say, systematic active versus indexing, I do think it can cause some confusion. And I want to spend more time there because I want to try to make it crystal clear for investors the differences here and really highlight the pros and cons of each. And on the indexing side, maybe this goes without saying, but any index is a human construct, right? This isn't some sort of methodology ordained by the investment gods or something like that, right? I just think it's interesting because you can look at, say, five different index-based small-cap ETFs. And you know this, you're going to find some real differences in terms of construction. It's not as easy as an investor saying, you know, look, I'm going to index my small cap allocation and voila, I magically capture everything that asset class has to offer. And so I'd love to have you maybe talk more of that because I just think it gets us in to really helping understand why Dimensional takes the approach it does.
Yeah, it's great. And first of all, I'm definitely using that line about not created by the investment gods because I really think that a lot of investors kind of tend to think of that way. The index is the market, right? And that's just not true. First of all, we have to acknowledge that indices have a lot of different perspectives on what, quote unquote, the market is. So a lot of people, if you ask them, say, well, how many indices do you think they are? They'll, you know, everybody will be able to name, you know, a couple to maybe a couple dozen, and they'll assume that they're going to miss some. So you kind of get estimates and maybe the hundreds or the low thousands. There's 3 million indices that are out there. And anytime that you have 3 million different perspectives on what the market is, you know that there are decisions that are being made there. And reasonably, investors might say, okay, yeah, well, listen, there might be 3 million indices, but how different do they look relative to one another? Does it matter, in other words? Does the choice really impact my investment experience? And you pointed out something that I think is really helpful, which is look at a couple of indices in a particular area of the market and see what the performance looks like relative to one another. And that unveils a lot about not only how differently they're constructed, but also how different the investment experience is. So you brought up U.S. small caps, and I think this is a great example. You look at the S&P 600, the Russell 2000, and the CRSP U.S. small cap index going back 20 years. On average, the difference between the top performing index and the bottom performing index in a given calendar year is over 5%. And when you think about how different that looks, you know, 5% difference, you could be talking about equities and fixed income in a given year. And here what you're talking about is the same exact asset class on the surface, U.S. small caps, and your average difference is 5%. I mean, that is mind-boggling to think about. And that's the average, right? Some years it's going to be lower. Some years it'll be, you know, 2%. Some years it'll be 12%. And so it's really difficult, I think, when you look at those results to say, oh, well, the index is just the market, because it really isn't. And it makes a big difference about what index you choose. And as I said before, it also starts to pull back the curtain a little bit and raise some questions about, well, if the results are so different, why? What are the decisions that are being made? Because clearly it's not as passive as a lot of investors might think.
Well, talk a little bit about some of those decisions that are being made, because as you go through that, a natural conclusion, at least for me, is that indexing is ultimately active in the sense that there are these active decisions being made in terms of the index methodology. And actually, in the case of some indices like the S&P 500, there's literally a committee deciding what to own. And I know they have rules and constraints, but there are true active decisions being made. So how do you think about those choices around index construction?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I love that you brought up the S&P index committee as well. I think that surprises a lot of people, because a lot of people think, well, an index is kind of just a book of rules. And by and large, that is mostly true. But as you brought up earlier, the book of rules that was created by investors. It was created by humans. There's bias in that. And then, of course, when you had an index committee on top of that, there's even more decisions. So let's talk about a couple examples of this. Let's talk about the Russell, first of all, which is a rule book. There isn't like an index committee that has like, you know, all, you know, overriding power to decide when stocks get added and which ones and what have you, like the S&P. So maybe the Russell represents more of a sort of a pure market exposure in some people's mind, because you're removing some of that bias. Well, think about what the impact of some of those rules is. So the Russell, for example, has decided that reconstitution in the index will only happen once a year. So what does it mean when you say that you should only revisit your holdings once a year? You're making a call that says, well, the market's not going to move that much in 12 months, so you don't really have to look at your holdings more than once a year. That is a very active decision that you've just made, and one that we know, even over the last couple of years, has proven to be completely wrong. I mean, think about what the last 12 months have held and how differently things look. Would you want your portfolio to have changed with that information? Do you want to adapt and incorporate that information, or are you just fine riding it out and just, you know, third Friday in June is when you look at your holdings once again? So clearly that is an example of something that not only is a decision, but really impacts what your investment experience can be like, particularly if you're invested in sort of a factor-based strategy. You know, you want to pursue small cap value names, for example, Russell 2000 value versus a DFSV, as I mentioned before. You know, what's small value today doesn't stay small value tomorrow or in the future. And there's lots of examples of that. One of my favorite ones to talk about is GameStop, right? When we saw GameStop explode from this tiny little small cap value name all the way up to be bigger than 40% of S&P 500 constituents, what would you want your small cap value manager to do? Would you want them to revisit that holding and exit the position and reinvest in small value, or would you want them to hold it for another 6 months? And that's the difference between the Russell and, you know, a dimensional portfolio. We sold in January at $350 a share, and if you were in the Russell, you held it and rode it all the way back down, pretty much. So that is a good example of a rule book. Now, you mentioned before the index committee, and I think that's fascinating as well. because, as you said, the S&P has a methodology book, like guidelines that they have about, you know, what they're going to be doing and sort of minimum criteria. But the index committee is really the one who makes the decisions about what's happening. And I think two things that are shocking for investors about this. Number one, we have no idea who's on the index committee. It's not public information. So it's anybody's guess as to the qualifications and the thought process of what goes into these decisions that are being made. So if you have questions about why the S&P did something, good luck finding answers, right? You're just going to have to speculate. And the second thing is, the index committee oftentimes makes decisions that are a lot more active than people might expect from an index. So one of my favorite examples I like to talk about is back in 2005, you know, Google had its IPO, was large enough to be included in the S&P 500 index, but it wasn't. And the chairman of the index committee actually came out and explained why Google wasn't part of the S&P 500 yet. And he said, well, it's just done so well. It's done so well that surely what goes up must come down. So here you have what's perceived to be a very, you know, unbiased, unemotional, unimpacted by human intervention type of a index, and they're doing technical analysis on their holdings. And by the way, if you go back and look at 2005, like pull up a price chart on your computer about what happened with Google, you know, since 2005, that downturn that they were expecting never came, right? It's essentially just a straight shot up. Not even straight, it's exponential if you look at it on the graphic. So, you know, not only are they making active decisions, but as you'd expect from someone who's making a lot of active decisions, a lot of them are wrong. So I think investors have to be able to look at that and say, am I comfortable with this rule book? Why was it created the way it was? And am I comfortable in an index committee making decisions when I don't know who they are? And I don't know what decisions they've made, but based on what they've done in the past, it doesn't always turn out well.
Rob, you mentioned the word bias earlier. And as you may or may not know, I like to occasionally play devil's advocate on ETF Prime. So I'm going to try to do that now. And the question that I have is, you mentioned rule book. And so once these index rules and constraints are set, and let's set aside an index committee, you know, sort of arbitrarily making some of these active decisions. Let's just say we have an index rule book. There is some rigidity in that, and that the index and ultimately an ETF that tracks it is simply going to follow those rules. And I would say from my perspective, that's what many investors view as a positive of indexing, in that it removes any human emotion in bias, at least mm-hmm. after the rules are set, right? Because we know how mm-hmm. detrimental human emotion and bias can be in investing. And you had a great example with GameStop. But, mm-hmm. you know, some people may say, well, that's an extreme example. And there's plenty of examples that may go the other way. So I guess my question is, do you agree that that rigidity can be a positive, at least when it comes to, you know, eliminating some of that human emotion and bias?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's two ways that you can kind of approach the concept of the rigidity in an index, which is, you know, number one, do you agree with the way that the rules have been set? So yes, the rules are rigid. Are those rules that you want to abide by in your portfolio? And then two is flexibility to deviate from those rules based on what you're seeing in the market important to you? So, you know, when you think about sort of the rules that you have about, you know, for example, what's small cap, what's value, you know, what's in your investment universe, you have to be able to sign off and say, yes, I think that, you know, the three metrics that Russell uses to evaluate value stocks are better than the eight metrics that MSCI uses. And I'm comfortable with that decision. And if the research evolves over time, and you learn more about where expected returns are coming from, which we know is always happening in the academic community, maybe you don't get to incorporate that information, right? Maybe that's something that you can't take advantage of because your index has its rules and they want to follow them, right? So that's number one is, do you agree with the rules? And I would say one of the things that you can think about with as an investor is, who made the rules? Where did they come from? You know, are the rules being constructed in accordance with the greatest minds in modern financial theory? Or is it just kind of a finger in the wind and said, you know what, the third Friday in June just seems like a good day to do rebalancing, right? So that's one thing. But the thing is about flexibility. And one thing when you see particularly in, you know, volatile markets, like we had, for example, in March of 2020, or you have in major market events like, you know, Russia or some of the sanctions that we've seen on Chinese securities, is do you want to be nimble and move quickly when information comes out in the market? So, for example, you know, the example I gave before, so those Chinese securities that were being sanctioned, we all knew that U.S. investors were going to have to divest themselves from those securities. So it's not a secret. Everybody holds them, and you're going to have to not hold them. If you are in an index fund, you're going to sell it at the same time every other index fund investor is going to sell it. And so that's going to create a lot of price pressure. You don't have flexibility around that information, even though you know it's going to happen. But if you're a different kind of asset manager that isn't as concerned with tracking error, then you can sell it in advance and you don't have to wait to have the same experience that everybody else has. And so, you know, in every aspect of our life, we know that flexibility is important. My chiropractor tells me that all the time. Right? That's why we, you know, try to get up and move from our desks every 15 minutes, every hour, whatever it is. But for some reason in our investments, the flexibility starts to become viewed as, you know, something that's bad. And I'm not saying that you should have unlimited discretion in a portfolio. It should be very clear about what your goals are and how you accomplish them. But, man, I'll tell you, especially when things are volatile and the market's going one way, flexibility is incredibly important and really can make the difference in your investment experience.
Rob, just a few minutes left here. I want to try to tie this all together and talk about how investors might actually use dimensionals ETFs. And I think as we've driven home here today, every investment decision is ultimately active, right? And so, again, if I just play devil's advocate and I think about dimensionals approach, isn't it a pretty active decision to tilt towards, say, small caps and profitability and value and some of the other factors dimensional prioritizes? Like, how does an investor know that's potentially a better path longer term? Because some of these factors have had significant underperformance over the past 10 or 15 years. So how should investors think about making those active tilts? I get everything you're saying in terms of the flexibility dimensional has, but how should investors think about that?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think we have to acknowledge right off the bat that there really isn't such a thing as an absence of decision making. If you're with dimensional, if you're with an index, if you decide to stick your cash under your mattress and not be in the market, all of those are decisions. I think what's helpful or more helpful in terms of a framework is, what are you basing your decisions off of? Do you feel good about those decisions and what's informed them? And, you know, when you pick up, you know, a financial analyst journal or any kind of new research that's highlighting some of the things that's being thought about or proposed in academia, no one can propose anything with any level of, you know, being taken seriously by their peers without regressing their research against exactly what we have incorporated in our strategies. If you don't run your analysis against the FAMA French three-factor model, you're going to get laughed out of the room because people are going to say, well, how do you know that's not just a size and value factor loading that's essentially explaining these returns that you're talking about? So I think that best-in-class research is incredibly important. And we also have to acknowledge exactly what you said. It's been challenging in the U.S. over shorter periods of time. That's definitely true. We've seen that in the past as well. You know, when we launched in 1981 as a microcap strategy was our first mutual fund, and microcaps didn't do well for the first few years that we were in business. But it's very intuitive that microcaps should do well, and they have, you know, since, and the long-term performance has been good. We also have to look outside the U.S. You know, I think as U.S. investors, we think the U.S. is the whole world and whatever we're doing is what everybody else is doing. The premiums are working phenomenally well in developed ex-U.S. markets and emerging markets as well. They've also worked really well over in the U.S. over longer time periods. You are in sort of a strange environment where right now, if your portfolio wasn't nothing but NVIDIA over the last year, then you didn't do as well as you could have. And, you know, will that be something that continues into the future? Are people comfortable buying companies that are trading at, you know, 33 times earnings? that's a question that you have to ask yourself and sort of stand back and say, does that make sense? Or is there a better way to think about what the future could hold and be happy with the gains that you've, you know, taken from some of those investments up until this point? So, you know, I think Dimensional's portfolios really serve a couple of different key areas in investors' portfolios. It can be the core, right, through our core equity market solutions. You want market-wide exposure. You want good implementation. You want some of that leading research from academia. That's great. It can also be used as a complement and say, hey, I really like the S&P 500. I just don't want to have my whole portfolio, you know, in the Mag 7, basically. And then you say, well, maybe I should add some small value or some targeted value in there to sort of balance things out a little bit. So we see investors do both. We're not here to say what's right or what's better. We're here to make the best investment products that we can and empower investor choice, ultimately.
Well, Rob, with that, we're going to have to leave it there. Just an excellent conversation this week. I just find this to be such an interesting topic, and I really appreciate you diving in here. I think this is really helpful to investors as they think through really those three broader buckets we talked about earlier. But thank you for joining me this week.
Of course. Thank you so much for the opportunity coming on the show. We really enjoyed it.
That was Rob Harvey, co-head of product specialists at Dimensional.